listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More U.S. sanctions for Russia, the latest being imposed over the Skripal case in the U.K. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero, live from Philadelphia via Skype on Thursday. Professor Montero, just trying to make sense out of the latest with these sanctions.
You know, which in one sense are puzzling, given Trump's meeting in Helsinki with Putin, and the article in Politico, which I think is kind of reliable, where the Russian government or the people around Putin kind of said what they talked about. And what they talked about were significant issues such as arms agreement about nuclear weapons, right. Agreements about no nuclear weapons in space, and about Syria, and, you know, recognition that there's not been an arms control agreement between the two largest nuclear weapons nations in the world. There's not been an agreement since 1993.
Yeah, plus there's been abrogation of a few of the most basic ones, too, in the intervening period.
Yeah. Or allowing them to you know, fizzle out because right. Their time frame had ended.
Right, they lapsed.
They lapsed, yes. And so now these sanctions over allegations about using chemical weapons to poison this former agent or... The Skripals in England. And how does that... rise to the level of a need for sanctions against Russia at a time when the two leaders are warming up to each other and talking about doing something substantive about nuclear weapons and other hot spots and tensions in the world. It seems to me that that Trump is isolated within his own administration. And this sounds more like Bolton and Pompeo and people around them than it does like Trump. And it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And they're even talking about tightening up on these sanctions. And eventually, some of them are saying, forbidding Aeroflot, the Russian airline, to land in the United States.
Yeah.
So we got, two diametrically opposite trends going on within the Trump administration.
Yep.
Now, I don't know how Trump is himself thinking about this. Maybe it's about the 2018 election, and the Republicans need to appear to be tough on Russia. There's been some language like that used by Trump in the recent weeks.
Yep.
About the Russians didn't really warn him and right. All of this type of thing.
I've been tougher on Russia than Obama was or Clinton, etc.
Yeah. And that's more, I think, stump rhetoric.
Yeah.
I don't know. But ultimately, it's quite dangerous. And then you have, the ratcheting up of sanctions against Turkey. And
yeah.
We should be reminded that never before had sanctions by any NATO nation been imposed upon another NATO nation.
That's right.
In other words, this is a serious issue and a serious blow, I would put it this way, to NATO and
yep.
Especially to its eastern flank, which can only drive Turkey out of NATO and closer to Russia, China, and Iran.
You've already had also, Turkey has been getting trying to join the EU for a really long time. And only in the last few years, has finally got it into its head that basically, guess what? They're not going to let us join their European club, period. And starting to chart out a little bit of an independent course. But I think also, if you look at the backdrop to this stuff, I just wanted, before we got further into Turkey with Russia, with all of this stuff going on with Russia, we had the day before yesterday a quote-unquote accidental firing of a missile from a NATO fighter jet at, more or less at the Russian border in Estonia. In other words, shooting a live fire missile from a plane at Russia over Estonia. It was apparently an accident and treated that way, but all this rhetoric takes place in a certain context where there's an awful lot of gasoline on the ground and a lot of people lighting matches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's very interesting you bring that up, because according to the Politico article that talks about the Russians' description of the meeting in Helsinki, one of the things that they talked about was drawing back NATO troops on the borders of Russia.
Right.
And there's all of this talk, you might remember, that, Trump wanted to make friends with Putin in order to focus upon China.
Right.
And apparently that is the advice that Kissinger gave to Trump.
Right.
That China is the big enemy and split Russia and China.
Right.
I think that it's obvious that for different reasons, Russia and China do constitute, quote, threats to American interest or hegemony. I think that, of course, that the Russia-China alliance is really what concerns politicians and planners and strategic planners in the United States and in other Western countries.
I mean, this is what they themselves have characterized now for the past few years as a strategic partnership.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the two leaders, Putin and Xi Jinping, have met, according to one count, 26 times since 2013. And they consider themselves good friends, and they consider their countries to be important allies. And, you know, one of the symbols of this is that the Russian and Chinese navies have carried out joint military exercises in the Sea of Japan and in the Mediterranean, Eastern Mediterranean. And it seems that they agree on a number of things in international relations, including Syria and North Korea, and arms talks and detente between the United States and Russia. But this is the great concern, and what this will mean. And of course, you know, Russia and Turkey are Asian nations, and China is an Asian nation, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a organization of Asian nations. And, you know, it's Asia, not just China, that is worrisome for Western strategic planners.
And one of the things people here don't keep in mind when they think about this, the largest nation state in, you know, the, in terms of geography in Asia is Russia. So Russia is also an Asian nation, not just a European nation.
It's mainly an Asian nation.
That's correct.
And, you know, it's always been this big question of whether Russia was Western or Asian.
That's right.
And, you know, the Tsars ruled over an empire that was primarily, essentially, Asian.
That's correct.
And they, the Tsars, were primarily Western. They spoke French in the Tsarist court. With the Russian Revolution, Russia acknowledged its Asian-ness.
That's right.
And really liberated tens of Asian nations from what was the rule of the Tsars, colonial rule. And so this Western thing is really not, has not played out to the advantage of the Soviet Union or Russia. And I think Putin and Erdogan in Turkey have decided that their natural home in terms of geopolitics is in Asia, and especially in a strong and united Asia with, you know, I would say at least half of the world's population is not only the future in the 21st century, but going forward as far as the eye can see. I would say that Asia as the center of global economic and political power is what we're looking at for the rest of the 21st century. And there's nothing that the United States or the West can do about it. And sanctions against, you know, Turkey or Russia or Iran only serves to bring them closer together and to bring all of them closer to China and eventually to India. I don't know what the likes of Bolton, John Bolton, and and Pompeo are thinking about, or any of the rest of them. Yep. Now, on his best days, Trump gets it right.
Yeah.
And on the worst days, Trump accedes to his, quote, advisors and gets it wrong. The issue going forward is who will win in this internal battle within the Trump administration. Whether Trump has enough strength, enough power in his own administration to win out on his policy of indeed economic competition, sometimes morphing over into trade wars, which are not good, or and detente, of course, which goes along with this, or whether the war hawks who represent the majority of the what we call the deep state, and of course the majority of the news media, whether that side wins out. Now, here is the great equalizer, I'll put it that way. The vast majority of American people, who, whether they state it like we do or not, applaud at rallies when Trump says to negotiate and to talk to leaders that we don't agree with is a good thing. And so this 40% of the electorate that stands with Trump, in spite of the attacks upon him for being an agent of Putin and the Russians having manipulated the election, that 40% that stand with him is, I think, the political foundation of what could be a new type of 21st century peace movement, as well as an anti-interventionist movement. And I think we have to come down on their side against the deep state.
You know, if a peace movement or anyone, you know, looking to demilitarize the condition of our species, I don't know what language to use for that, but that would be the ultimate goal, to get out from the burden of you know, having these military budgets and all the people dying and all the stuff getting blown up and all of the fuel being burned and all of the horrible things that are consequent to that. You know, there are only a very few paths to that. One is, you know, a global revolution, particularly revolution inside the countries that are the largest military threats, and specifically a revolution in the United States, an anti-militarist, you know, essentially socialist revolution. You know, I checked my calendar. That's not scheduled yet. Okay, so, I mean, I'll show up. I'll even help them promote it when it's time, but I don't think it's scheduled yet. Then, because honestly, no one's really hired anybody to do it, and we don't know who the bride and groom are going to be, let alone where to buy the invitations. So then we've got another alternative, which is to force the existing, you know, structures to behave in a way that is in accord with what we want. In other words, if we can't put in a new government under a new system that doesn't require war and war making to thrive for itself, then we find a way of having the present system accommodate itself to a condition of, you know, no war and demilitarization. And so that means either you elect a new government, which of course is not the way out thus far. You can ask just about anybody who's elected, just about anybody. I mean, you're going back to Nixon promising the end of the Vietnam War and a secret plan in 1968 that took, 4 years or 6 years after that of intense pressure from us to every one of them. So probably that's not the route either. And certainly no one on the horizon that would replace Trump is saying anything remotely like, let's de-escalate tensions with Russia and China, see if we can't start cutting our militaries in half and then half again, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's not the language of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, for that matter. So you have then, okay, well, Trump is all we got. He's in power. How do we pressure him, incentivize him, induce him to move forward? And that means engagement. And no one is discussing how to engage the administration to do some of the things that it says it wants to do.
Or I think, you know, I would look at it a bit differently. I think the key question, and this is what we've talked about over these many months, is how do you engage that base, that Trump base?
Right.
You know, that's the first thing.
Yeah, but I'm not referring specifically, literally, to two-dimensional administration. Yeah. I'm talking about there's the president guy there. These are the people that are keeping him in that job.
Absolutely.
You know, that whole contraption. Yeah.
That's right. But, you know, I think what is a growing awareness among the people, and here I'm not talking about politicians or the existing political parties, there is a recognition of the dictatorship of finance capital and the havoc and brutality that it has brought upon the American people and the people of the world. I mean, if we're talking about the decline in the standard of living of the working people and middle classes, and if we are talking about austerity in times where the 0.1% are more wealthy than ever, and the growing inequalities that has wrought, and everybody is talking about that, certainly from the time of Occupy, and of course the Trump candidacy continually brought attention to that, and in his rhetoric and in his campaign, it was a out and out attack upon the financial oligarchs of this country and the institutions that support them, like the media. That is why this great struggle over whether the Republican Party will be the old type Republican Party, or whether it will become a Trump Republican Party or Trump Party altogether. Because if it becomes a populist party, you know, a party that is more anchored to the needs and interests of working people and the lower middle classes, the lower professional classes, then it will have to increasingly take on the dictatorship of the financial oligarchy. But at the same time, that means that objectively, this is a democratic movement with a small d, a movement for a people's democracy, for power to the people. I would say in many ways, this is short of an out and out socialist revolution, but it is, there is the potential for a political revolution that does not, you know, at one, you know, swoop, do away with all of capitalism, but attacks that tiny minority, which has a dictatorship over the economy, over politics, over the legal system, and on and on and on. I think that's what we're looking at. I don't think we're that far away from that. And if that is the trajectory, then other things are part of it, such as a moving back from military intervention, of moving back from tension, military tensions and other kinds with Russia and China. And, you know, in this respect, this, what I think is not maybe yet a minority, but a significant part of the American people are in alignment with the majority of people around the world, certainly with the majority of Europeans who are continually voting against the old policies of subservience to U.S. militarism, to the U.S. 1%, the U.S. financial oligarchs, and so on. And clearly, in this majority, this human, this the political majority in the world, I mean, you have to include the Russians, the Chinese, the Indians, most of the Africans, and people in South and Central America. I mean, we're somewhere where we have not been, and it's a good place, and it requires, at the end of the day, a huge amount of political education, which cannot, you know, we cannot just depend upon Trump's rhetoric and that populism. It has to go to another level. And this means, of course, challenging the news, so-called news media, and so that dominate the atmosphere, the ideological atmosphere.
See, I think one of the problems that I would say maybe the problem that we face is perhaps the same one that we've had to face in this country since its founding, which is the divisions that exist among the members of the working class. You know, white supremacy being the prize that was handed out, you know, to keep this big chunk at odds with, or to allow whatever to happen to everybody else as long as they were still getting paid a little bit at the end of the week. You know, that paycheck stopped, you know, being honored at the bank a long time ago, pretty much. It may get honored if the cops drive down the street and decide, well, we're going to shoot somebody today. Who's it going to be? But in terms of, you know, who's going to get that high-paying job or who's going to get this, that, or the other thing, this system ain't handing out much to anybody anymore except really rich people. You know, the virtual currency is good for a while. Right. But when your stomach starts growling, you know, and you start looking for, you know, you look at your balance sheet, and you see that there's a minus before all those big numbers that were that didn't used to be, that it gets thin pretty quick. And so the material basis for that those divisions is eroding in some ways, even though the fact of the immiseration of everybody is a kind of a dangerous mix, because a lot of folks will sell out real quick just to get out of the, you know, what looks like a desperate situation coming. And so,
and you know something, Don, I couldn't agree with you more. And the empirical evidence for what you're saying is not so much in the large cities on the East and West Coast, but in places like Chattanooga, Tennessee, or Allentown, Pennsylvania, or Akron, Ohio,
Cleveland,
or Birmingham, Alabama. And I'm mentioning small or medium-sized cities that were driven by industry. And the industrial oligarchs of the past used the race card to keep the working class divided and thus subservient. But with the decline and deindustrialization of all of these areas, the working class in general has been impoverished and is being more impoverished. This is, I think, the objective conditions for the type of radical people's movements that we are talking about and have talked about, you know, since 2016 are better now than they have perhaps ever been. It's just that there is no left to guide it, to give leadership to it. I think out of this economic and political chaos, indigenous organic leaders will arise. And the type of populism that you and I are interested in will rise out of this political and economic chaos. And that is why, you know, Trump makes a fatal political error in thinking that he can play within the parameters of white supremacy and racist thinking, and use the white masses as the vanguard of his political populism. But that's not going to work.
Can't work.
And I think he underestimates his own base. I think among those people who voted and continue to support Trump, there is a huge group that rejects out-and-out racism, you know, that yep. sees the, you know, the economics of this thing, of this situation, and are really looking for some form of unity, especially with black working people and the black poor. And this is what we have to, you know, work on continually. And I think Trump fails at that point. He can't have it both ways. You know, you can't be a genuine economic populist and political populist and at the same time try to work within old racist paradigms of thinking.
Well, I mean, and there's the old okey-doke, because here's what happens. He does that, and let's give him the benefit of the doubt for argument's sake. Let's say he's doing it for the constructive intended purpose of trying to do some good for the working class as a whole, which he does say while he's doing this. Mm-hmm. And the response, of course, is from the other side, because it's politically exactly where they need to go, and it also accomplishes the same goal that this did in installing white supremacy, what he's practicing. The response also helps to install it, and that is, well, then things are about race. He's making it about race, and they're not about class. Right. And so the opposition is organized around the question of race instead of class. Mm-hmm. And so now you have two camps at each other's throats, and nobody's talking about class. And that is, the intended goal. We got to stop here, or maybe we'll pick it up there next week, Tony. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The transatlantic relationship has had many ups and downs since its inception after the Second World War. It is said this relationship has weathered these moments of tensions and differences due to American leadership. Enter Donald Trump. Can the transatlantic relationship survive the current occupant in the White House? Crosstalking the transatlantic relationship, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Maloof in Washington. He is a former senior security policy analyst in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. In London, we have Indrajit Palmar. He is a professor of international politics at City University London. And in Oxford, we cross to Mark Allman. He is the director of the Crisis Research Institute. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Mark first in Oxford on Skype. You know, Mark, these last few programs, I keep betraying my age. Well, I can remember a good part of the history of the transatlantic relationship. And there have been ups and downs. There have been policy differences. We can think of Vietnam. We can think of the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. During the Reagan administration, it was intermediate missiles. And they've pretty much been resolved. Those were problems. I get the impression now that it's turning into divisions about values the position of each in the world, because the Europeans, after all these decades, have pretty much, you know, tied themselves to the United States and have very limited options, and they're not very happy about it. Is this a crisis of ideology and values now, not just policy issues? Mark in Oxford.
Well, I think it's a mixture. It's a crisis of values where there's a big disagreement about what is important and what should be principles between Berlin and Paris on the one side and Washington on the other, shall we say. But it's also about valuables. In many ways, the Atlantic Alliance from the late 40s onwards was one in which the United States was prepared to pay an economic price for security and geopolitical advantage. And so the Marshall Plan and onwards meant that there were certain trade imbalances that revived the European, West European economies, and initially at the expense of the United States, but overall everybody benefited. Now Trump is saying it has to be a cost-benefit analysis on a day-to-day basis, and putting America first means that America has to come out on top. And that, of course, is causing serious problems to European industries, European finance in general, because suddenly the United States is throwing spanners in the works in all sorts of directions, pulling out of the Iran deal, sanctions on Russia and so on, which have a big effect. And then also Trump articulates a view of the world which the European elites and, to a great extent, the European media regards with abhorrence, to be quite frank. And so there's a problem. And then there's a problem even with the British as the closest ally to the United States. They find themselves challenged economically and also challenged to some extent on what is publicly acceptable here. And Trump, of course, hasn't helped by tweeting about things in Britain that have gone against the grain of British public opinion.
Interject, if I can stay with the British Isles here. The issue, on the very top of this, we have the Iran deal that the U.S. withdrew from. But it seems to me that that is an archetype of the problems of the transatlantic relationship right now, because the Europeans are being told that they have to pay an economic price when they're staying in the deal, and Iran wants to stay in the deal too. I mean, it seems a bit large on the part of the United States saying, well, since we don't want to be part of it, you shouldn't be part of it. And this gets down to really kind of sovereignty, at least EU sovereignty. I'd like to talk a little bit about energy as well. But, I mean, the Europeans are being asked to go against their best interests in almost every single way. And this is causing a great deal of tension. Go ahead, in London.
I think, yeah, you've summarized the position in some respects, but I do not think that it is a kind of fundamental breach. I think the Europeans are clearly unhappy. The one major diplomatic success, if you like, they can claim was the Iran nuclear agreement, and they're very upset at the United States' withdrawal from it. But on the other hand, their ideas about Iran and Iran's regional power and its ballistic missile testing, they don't differ very much. So I think they would appear to be a big tactical difference here. And so what I would argue is that at the core of transatlantic relations from the very beginning, I don't think there was ever any altruism involved. There was always a position of power and a negotiation about power and power distribution. So I think what the situation is now is that it's changed. And to some extent, there's a renegotiation of those relationships. And I don't think it's only the United States which is acting much more towards its particular national interests. European powers among themselves have always had a tension between the European element and their national interests. So I think this is just being exacerbated at this particular time. And clearly Donald Trump plays a particular game. But I think in the end, the levels of interdependence between the European Union, Europe, and the United States remain very, very high. And I think there is a bit of upset here, but I don't think there's a fundamental breach.
Well, we'll see here.
There are many tensions which have listed a
right,
long
right.
time.
Let me go to Michael in Washington. I mean, interdependency, I think there's a lot more dependency than interdependency, and that's what we're seeing right now. And I guess fundamentally, can we have a transatlantic alliance, coalition, as it were? Can it coexist with America First and Donald Trump? Michael.
Well, it's beginning to erode. What we're seeing is an erosion and perhaps a replacement of the U.S.-led unilateral world order. And I think that the breaking out or leaving the Iranian deal, the JCPOA, was a watershed moment for countries in Eurasia and especially Iran, as well as in Western Europe. And what we're seeing emerge now is a new geopolitical shift to a much more multipolar approach. And we're already seeing this, just like what you probably saw in St. Petersburg with the Belt and Road Initiative, combined with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Eurasia European Union, all beginning to come together with its membership, forming this separate economic world order bloc that's actually going to counter and respond to what Donald Trump has now done. I think Europe as well, because of the sanctions, are going to rebel to as much as they can, and we're going to see that they're going to want to maintain that trade with Iran as well as with the other countries in that in that region of the world. The whole idea, because the United States insists upon having the Israeli policy interfere with every foreign policy decision it makes, yeah. it's actually beginning to shift away from that, and we're seeing that already.
Mark, it seems that there's a perception, I've heard this many times, that the United States is treating its friends worse than its enemies. I mean, it's essentially going down a track of threatening to sanction European countries and their companies. And this is getting, I think it's the first time in the Transatlantic Alliance experience where, sovereignty really seems to is being infringed upon. I mean, threatening companies, their financial transactions, it's forcing companies to start trading in other currencies. So the U.S. Treasury Department can't go after you. I mean, is that what NATO allies are supposed to be worried about from the United States now? I mean, this is a new dilemma that this coalition, this alliance is facing. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I think I can show my age by saying I do remember when even Mrs. Thatcher had a falling out with Ronald Reagan over the U.S. attempt to prevent the export of then Soviet gas to Western Europe and yep. to prevent British companies taking part in that. So there have been precedents. The point is that in those cases, quite quickly, the common interest overrode the divisions and they found a way out of it. Whereas today, we face the prospect, I think, that Donald Trump almost certainly be in office for the remainder of this term. He could be re-elected. And if he continues with these policies, he's really challenging the European sense of self-esteem in the one area where they feel like a great power. Yes, the EU is a geopolitical pygmy, is a military pygmy, but it is a trading superpower. Germany alone, after all, exports more than the United States imports, and that's a lot of exports. So Germany and China, for instance, and also, say, countries like Japan, have an economic common interest in the wider world, which Trump is trying to unsettle because, of course, he wants to cut back dramatically the U.S. trade deficit. But that actually means hitting, to a great extent, his key partners, as well as a potential geopolitical rival like China. So we really have structural changes taking place. Maybe all these decades of cooperation, all the cultural contacts between West and the United States and the broader West will somehow or other tend to mitigate this. But I have a feeling that in the end, it will be dollars and cents that count.
Yeah. Interjet, let me go back to you in London. I mean, right before Trump withdrew from the Iran deal, we had Boris Johnson visiting. We had Emmanuel Macron visiting Trump as well. And I think that they were expecting some kind of negotiation like allies and friends are supposed to do. And they returned home empty handed. In the meantime, Angela Merkel has visited Putin twice and gone to China. She didn't even go to Washington. There's a perception, at least on this side of the pond, is that the United States isn't interested in negotiations. It's more interested in diktat. Do it or else. Go ahead in London.
Well, actually, Angela Merkel did go to Washington, D.C. and meet with
before.
Donald Trump prior
well,
to
before.
The
right.
withdrawal, yes. Along with Macron, for example, just after Macron, and was given a slightly different kind of treatment. I think there's a very complicated question, and I think to some extent there's a kind of broad long-term shift going on in the kind of global geopolitics and geoeconomics, and I think then there are these kind of tactical transactionalisms which Trump is championing, and I think to some extent Trump is being criticized, but in the end he's standing up for what he believes is the American national interest.
And he's keeping his promises. Let's keep that in mind. It shouldn't be surprising, okay? He said this on the campaign trail. Keep going.
Yes, and I think what I would say about that to you is that I think a large part of this is really a sort of tactical power play. And it's as much directed at home, at his political base, to try to show them that he is standing up for the United States. The key thing that he had promised, really, that America First was going to do for them was to basically give them back economic and other hope. And I don't think actually any of this is going to help that core base at all. So in the end, effectively, it's a big theater. And I think the levels, the amounts of money we're talking about here in regard to the kind of sanctions on trade or trade tariffs or whatever is relatively small. It could lead to more, but I think in the end, I don't think this is a massive shift.
And trade wars usually start small here. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the transatlantic relationship. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
I'm going to go back to Michael in Washington. One of the interesting questions that have risen that isn't given much coverage is the energy politics and energy security that includes the UK, the rest of Europe, the United States, and interestingly and importantly, Russia here. And Germany is very much in the center of it with the Nord Stream pipeline, the second one that's going to be is being built. And the Americans are profusely against this pipeline because they want to import or export to Europe very expensive LNG. And the Germans are resisting it, and they could face sanctions. As we talk, announcements could be made. This is a very important issue because Germany and the European Union are actually de facto being denied the ability to determine their energy security. It's the U.S. wants to dictate that. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, it has to do with Russian dominance of it, and that's the problem. And the U.S., as you point out, is a Johnny-come-lately to this in wanting to ship LNG or liquefied natural gas. But the problem for the United States is it only has one port in Louisiana that can export it. And secondly, most of the European countries, except those along the coasts, have any LNG capabilities. The countries that really, really need this kind of gas are much more internally, and certainly Germany as well. But the pipeline structures that exist right now and are being built with Russian dominance, if you will, is what's irritating the neocons here in Washington and certainly the Trump administration. So it's a Johnny-come-lately effort, and I don't think it's going to succeed. And they need natural gas now because winter is not all that far away, and they have to have a reliable source. And you're going to see more and more of these countries integrating themselves apart from the United States because of this activity. And energy is just one aspect of that whole geopolitical shift that we're seeing emerge at this point.
You know, let me go back to Oxford. Mark, again, it gets down to being able to make sovereign decisions. I mean, I don't think you have to be very ideological or very partisan to question, well, why should a country that's on the other side of the planet determine your energy policy when you have a neighbor that wants to provide energy at a reasonable price and your companies are involved in a joint venture to build that pipeline? I mean, I don't see how threatening that possibly could be, except for you want the market. You want the market share. I get that. That's fine. Okay. But it should be the Europeans that ultimately make that decision. Mark in Oxford.
Well, obviously, to some extent, also the United States would like to weaken Russia's position by weakening the state revenue by cutting its exports of energy. But as the Austrian president, Van der Bellen, said, the great problem is that LNG is only economically viable when energy prices are high. And actually, because you negotiate long-term contracts with Russia to receive gas, you get the gas well below the price at which LNG is viable. So you have this, it is what I suppose our Marxist friends would call a dialectical contradiction. In order to make LNG viable, you have to create a high revenue stream for Russia, which makes Russia stronger and makes it more fearful to the West. But if you try to, and if you also have bad relations with Iran, pull out of the Iran deal, you push up energy prices. So actually you make the position of these countries that you are hostile to or suspicious of stronger. And also you make their ability to offer rebates to customers more attractive. So it actually is not a very clever policy, it seems to me. It's not going to achieve what it's intended to.
Okay, let me go back. Let's change gears here. I'd like to talk a little bit about NATO. Ever since the advent of the Cold War and the Warsaw Pact, we've had NATO. When the Soviet Union came to an end, NATO decided to stick around and look for a new mission for itself. Unfortunately, in 2018, I guess that mission is to defend against Russia. But the European countries don't really want to pay for their defense. They kind of like having the U.S. pick up the tab. Trump says you got to pay more, and they still don't do it. So it's kind of hard to convince publics that Russia is such a threat if you don't want to pay for your own defense. Except for Poland wants to spend $2 billion to have American troops there. Well, why don't they just give the $2 billion to the Germans, and the Germans can do it for them, okay? I mean, there's a lot of possibilities there, okay? Again, countries that want to have secure borders, particularly vis-a-vis Russia, they don't want to pay for it. So how do you square the circle there? Go ahead, in London.
Well, I think in Germany, actually, there are quite strong pressures from various sides of the political spectrum to strengthen German military power and also its kind of much more independent stance on a number of global questions. So I don't think there is an unwillingness on the part of many of the European powers, which of NATO, to increase military spending to 2%, which is what they're actually committed to under
There's a lot of resistance to reach that 2% of GDP. Well, I mean, they've been talking about it for years, and they're still not doing it. Okay, what? Only four countries out of the entire bloc actually do that. Okay, I mean, they still resist doing it. So that doesn't cut water with me. No, they want something for free, and then if they don't get it for free, they don't want to pay for it. That's how, Michael, you worked at the Defense Department.
Yeah. Well, I see that the emphasis is more on economic betterment between Europe and Russia, because that is they have a major dependency there. But the whole military concept has basically evaporated in favor of more economic opportunities, such as in dealing with Iran, dealing with China, dealing with Russia. I mean, it's expanding, and NATO, as you pointed out, is still an entity trying to find a new mission, and they went to Afghanistan for a little while. They're still there, but you know, it's on life support, frankly, and the Europeans for itself is looking internally to have its own defense mechanism, and the French are pushing that pretty much, and I think the Germans, because of what Trump has been doing and the way he's been bludgeoning them, I think they're beginning to re-examine that concept, but they don't see the threat that that the neocons and Trump do from Russia, from China, or from Iran, as Trump does.
Okay, Indra, let me go back to you in London, because you didn't get to really finish your point there. I mean, do you think that there is the political will? I mean, the European Union, for all of its problems, is one of the richest places on the planet. I mean, it's not like it doesn't have resources. It has plenty of resources. Unfortunately, a lot of them are wasted, but they still are relatively rich. Why shouldn't they just, you know, step up and really, if they're complaining about the United States and Trump, why don't they just go it alone? Like, it's not as if they don't have the resources to do it. Go ahead.
Well, I think going it alone is probably unviable for any major power or bloc today. That interdependence which has built up is very, very dense. The networks, which are financial, economic, political, security, intelligence, as well as people-to-people, ideas, in every respect, you look at the interdependencies of major global pillars. They are very, very great. They're not going anywhere. You can try to shake them up. You can rearrange them a little bit. You can renegotiate relations. And I think that's what Trump is trying to do, and some other powers are trying to do as well. But I don't think you're going to get rid of that. I don't think Europe wants to or can go alone. Britain is finding itself. Look at the position we're in now, negotiating a Brexit deal. Look how difficult it is to try to do anything meaningful with that. Because in the end, you cannot just divorce yourself from a global economy and so on. What you can do is try to create a sort of national conditions under which you can control the effects of globalism. And I think that is what is effectively happening on a worldwide scale. Because the people of the countries within, like the United States and elsewhere as well, they're suffering from the effects of inequality. They're suffering from the fact there's unemployment because of technological change and innovation. And I think people like Donald Trump are effectively misleading their own electorates by calling for America first. And I don't think they're going to solve any of those problems. But in the end, that is where the pressure is really coming from. And I think that is not going to go away. And that is going to lead to a degree of national level of control. So I think there's going to be a renegotiation of the kind of global compact, which allows for local control a bit more.
It's pretty pessimistic what you just said, because it sounds like all these organizations are straitjackets. You're in it and you can't get out. And there's one hegemon that will determine the rules. I mean, that's essentially what you're saying. Mark, I mean, I think that there is a political will and division. I think that there could be much more multi-polarity. I think there could be a lot more equality in it. But I don't see the political will. The Europeans can moan and groan all they want, but they're fat and happy with the situation the way it is. And Trump is, and the U.S. is going to be able to snipe at them, and they won't be able to do much about it. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I think also there is a problem when we're talking about the Europeans. Who do we mean? There is the networked elites of people who are involved in government and so on, who are very comfortable with the old order, and in a sense they're unhappy about Trump shaking it up, but also they can't imagine leaving it. But then we've seen, whether it's the Brexit vote, the Italian election, even the Austrian elections and so on, a huge popular unrest, including in Germany, with all sorts of aspects we've been hearing about of the downsides of globalization. That's why Trump, after all, won presidency in the United States. So I think there is a crisis of the West, and in a way, it's something which the elites in the EU and NATO don't really notice. It struck me that NATO has just held its first meeting in its new purpose-built headquarters, and the only law of sociology that I respect is Cecil Parkinson's law, that any organization that moves into a brand new purpose-built headquarters will go bust within 18 months. And one fears that we have this kind of institutional inertia that can't really imagine that the architecture that's been built up over the previous decades is seeing its foundations sapped away by the very popular consent, which after all was the basis of a democratic alliance.
Okay, Michael in Washington, last 40 seconds of the program goes to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is that the erosion of that unilateral world order, and it's beginning to catch up to reality is beginning to catch up to the Europeans, just like with Theresa May. She's doing Brexit, of course. She looked to the U.S. as an alternative market, but because of sanctions, now she's going to be looking more and more toward China. And I think you're going to see that wave increasing in the coming years, simply because we have this new multipolar emerging that is going to just isolate the U.S. unless it stops its batting people over the head all the time.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if America First can coexist with the transatlantic alliance that has existed since the Second World War. Seems pretty incompatible to me, but we'll see. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, London, and in Oxford. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.